Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. The Stand is proudly supported by Tesco. Tesco would like to thank customers for continuing to follow the in-store safety measures that help protect us all at this time. Now, more than ever, every little helps. Now, the COVID crisis continues to be the most important thing in the lives of people everywhere as of this moment. In Ireland yesterday, another 23 deaths were announced, 1,378 new cases of infection. But really, the problems, these are lower figures than most of last week. So there is an apparent trend. However, on all fronts, from the economy to the schools to the stresses and strains put on our health services and very much on the front line, people working in the health service, things are about as bad as they've ever been. And to discuss where we go now from here, not just in terms of the virus, but the vaccines, it's a pleasure to welcome to the Stand Professor Anthony Staines, who's a specialist in health systems and public health. Professor Staines is also a member of the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group, which believes we should be aggressively suppressing this virus with the intention of getting as close as we can to a zero COVID policy. Anthony, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
On The Stand. And I want to ask you about the depth of this crisis first, and particularly as it affects the frontline workers. And I saw a figure last week that up to 6,000 frontline workers had either been out with the virus, were close contacts of somebody with the virus, or had childcare issues that prevented them from going to work. I'm not sure about the veracity of that number, but it's in the thousands anyway. How much of a threat is that in itself to us?
It's a huge threat to maintaining services. It's one of the biggest challenges for a service manager because it is unpredictable. Someone goes home, they suddenly discover they're a close contact of someone who may be waiting for a test, who may have just been diagnosed with COVID, and they can't come in for the next shift. And managers all over the country are ringing up people at an hour's notice saying, can you please come in and take this? Can we move you here? Can we move you there? And it's very hard on the people. It's very hard on the patients, the service users, the clients, whomever it may be. But it's one of the biggest challenges of keeping services running in COVID situation.
Now, your colleague and fellow specialist, Jerry Killeen, is working in Cork University Hospital. He's spent a long time in Africa working in infectious diseases. And he said about 10 days ago that for the first time in this pandemic experience, he felt, and I quote, frightened by what he was seeing. Can you understand that fear? And can you tell us what you think the reason for a man of that experience is feeling frightened?
Yes, I can. I don't have Jerry's experiences, but I do share his real fear as to where this might all go. And I became really, really worried when I saw the case numbers rocketing in Ireland over the Christmas period. We'd always expected that there would be a rise because the government chose to open up at a time when there were a lot of cases. We were expecting a lot of people to come to Ireland over Christmas, that we'd urged that as few as possible should come. But the scale of the rise was the upper limit of anything that anyone had modelled. It was within the realms of our models, but it was the very, very bad end of our models. And we were just horrified because we could not see where this might stop. We were getting 1,000 cases a day, then suddenly it was 2,000 and 4,000 and 5,000 cases. And there seemed no special reason it shouldn't become 10,000 cases a day.
Yes.
But, you know, the Irish public rallied when they were asked. They've done huge work reducing the amount of contact they have. So the Irish public, for the third time, have done what the government asked them to do, have reduced their social contacts. Many people are restricting their lives. Many people are not working. Many businesses are under severe stress. But the government is not filling in their side of the bargain.
Yes.
My colleagues in DCU launched a report this morning on family businesses. There's a centre there that studies family businesses. Many family businesses in Ireland are seriously worried that they will simply cease to exist over the next 6 to 9 months.
Yes.
It is hoped that the vaccines will really bring this under control at the back end of this year. And given the supply issues with AstraZeneca, with Pfizer, it seems plausible that it'll be November or maybe even December of this year before the vaccines kick in. Many companies are saying, well, we haven't got another two lockdowns in us. One of my colleagues tweeted yesterday that she'd survived wave one and wave two, but wave three was really taking it out of her and she didn't think she could do anymore.
Yes.
And I don't think she's unique. We're looking at colleagues in Australia, colleagues in New Zealand, where life is not back to normal, but it is largely back to normal.
Yes.
Largely back. The economy is back. Jobs are back. Shops are open. The music business is back. I know people in the music business who've had no income since last March. They haven't done a paying job since last March. And they are wondering, will they ever work again in their chosen careers?
Yes.
In New Zealand, they could do gigs.
Yes.
So that shows that it can be done. I mean, there's a very stark figure. New Zealand had 2,500 cases over the course of their pandemic. We had 2,500 cases a day last week.
Yes.
We're about the same size.
Yes.
Why are we not getting on top of this?
Well, please go on.
You know, that's a question. We have to ask the government that, because the population have done what they can do, but yes, the government has not done what it can do.
No, and the let me, before we get to what we require to do and get to New Zealand and Australia as examples, and indeed Taiwan, but particularly New Zealand and Australia, because the question of quarantine is very much in play there. And in the case of Australia, of course, there are many states, there's a federal system there. However, I want to ask you about the medical questions here around the new variants. There is the UK variant, which is here now, and we are told, and you'll, I'm sure, confirm one way or the other, that it's over 60% of our cases now are caused by a new variant of this virus that is more virulent. And some have said, including Boris Johnson, but he was retracted, or his health secretary, actually, Matt Hancock, that it was 50% more deadly. There are new variants from UK, South Africa, Brazil. How much worse of a problem do these new variants present to our people and, of course, to the health service that has to deal with this?
Quite significant, first of all. There is good evidence that at least two of the new variants spread more rapidly than the existing strains of the virus that are circulating. And the implications of that are that if nothing else changes, there will be more cases, more sick people, more people in hospital and unfortunately more people dying. There's a separate question, and this can be confusing, but it's a separate question. If you are infected with this, with one of these new strains, are you more likely to get seriously ill, more likely to go to hospital, and more likely to die? So the answer to the first question is yes, these are more transmissible. That's, I think, at this point, unequivocal. The answer to your second question is there is some evidence that says the new UK strain, which is the main strain in Ireland now, north and south, makes people sicker, makes you more likely to go to hospital, and may make you more likely to die. But it's not certain. The evidence is unclear, but it certainly points in that direction. But watch this space. Hopefully it isn't, but we'll see.
Now, the vaccines and the efficacy of the vaccines, I suppose we can't lump them all together, but let's take the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, the efficacy of that. In terms of these new variants, are we unclear, as some public commentary has suggested, whether the new variants from Brazil, South Africa in particular has been mentioned in this regard, will be resistant to vaccines that are presently there? In other words, that this virus has mutated beyond the scope of the vaccine that was developed to combat it?
At the moment, we're not clear. What people are doing is they're looking at the structure of the protein made by the virus that sticks out, what they call the spike protein, which is the bit that sticks onto cells in your body.
Yes.
And so structural biologists have looked at the British strain, the B117, and have said they think it looks very similar to the existing strains. That should not be a problem. They've looked at the South African strain and said it does look a bit different. And there is a test tube study, and it is only in test tubes, not in humans, not in experimental animals, that says this new strain may not be bind to the antibodies that our vaccine currently produces, as well as existing strains. We don't yet know if that matters.
Yes. Okay. And
we're not going to know for a while.
Yes. And one other thing we don't know. Well, there's so many things we don't know. We don't know, for example, if the vaccine prevents you from transmitting the virus to somebody else. I'm right in that, Anthony, yes?
It's not certain yet. There is some very preliminary evidence from Israel which says that it may prevent transmission, or at least reduce transmission, which, if it's confirmed, is great news. You know, that's what everyone hopes.
Yes.
But again, it's going to take some time before we know one way or the other.
Now, the speed of the vaccine distribution and the way that Europe has responded, and by Europe I mean the EU, we look like this has been, the European Medicines Agency has been slower than the British to authorize these vaccines, to approve of them officially. And that's probably a good thing, is it, Anthony? Because we don't want to be jumping the gun. When the British first introduced the vaccine, it was under emergency measures. That's not ideal, is it?
It's not ideal, but it may sometimes be necessary. But the European Medicines Agency is saying we're proposing to give this to something like 500 million people. We need to be really confident that these vaccines are safe before we roll them out on this scale. And we also need to be confident that we have the tools in place. If there is a side effect from one of these vaccines, which is rare, we need the tool. We won't find that in the trials that have been done. There are very big trials of good quality done, But if we have a rare side effect which affects 1 in 100,000 people, 1.5 million people, we won't see that in the trials. So we have to have the mechanisms in place to track it. So one of the things we are saying to the public is, if you notice something strange after you receive a dose of the vaccine, tell someone about it. It may be nothing. We have a good handle on the usual side effects of all of these vaccines because they've been given to many tens of thousands of people.
Yes. Now, I met a nurse last week, Anthony. I was in a hospital and she'd had the vaccine. And she was a young woman, and she said, I said, how did it go? She said, well, she said, I had it done at 3 o'clock in Phoenix Park. I went home and I woke up at 3 a.m. in the morning feeling sick as a dog with a fever. And it didn't go great for her, but she was fine the next day. But I'm not saying that to in any way discourage people. It's just a fact, but an interesting. What I really want, or I'm sure our listeners want to know, is this. Is it possible that we will have to have a COVID shot of vaccine every year in the way that we have the flu vaccine? If that's if it's premature to be asking that question, in your view, don't have to answer it. But a lot of people wonder about that. Or is that one of the unknowns, known unknowns, as it were, that are out there?
It is possible, but if that happens, it would represent an enormous failure on the part of the world.
Yes.
This is a new infection. It kills about 1 in 100 of the people who get it. We've seen in Brazil that even when you have 3/4 of the population have been infected, so 3/4 of the people are presumably immune, you can still have a really, really bad outbreak with the remaining quarter. So it looks like this is a virus that will potentially affect everybody.
Right.
If we let this virus run loose, it is a gross failure of international public health. We don't, if we choose to let this run loose, it will probably require repeated vaccinations. We don't know yet, but that's very likely.
When it becomes, it could become endemic in our society.
It could, but it's very, very nasty. We have one nasty endemic disease already, which is influenza.
Yes.
This is much worse than influenza and will cost much more than influenza. Flu costs billions every, yes, every flu season.
Yes.
This will cost hundreds of billions every if there is a coronavirus season. We don't know that yet. But whenever it comes back, the costs will be astronomical. And WHO have been doing some work on the costs of this with, I think, OECD. The world cannot afford to let this run loose. It would be much cheaper to put the investment in now to get rid of it, to bring it under control, to stop it. But governments have to do that. Now, governments across Africa with no money, very little that we might recognize as a modern developed economy, have chosen to do this. They've put their resources, they've prioritized this. It is shameful the way that the rich countries of the world have dithered about this. And we're, yes, paying a really heavy price,
yes,
for it. But that's been our choice. It hasn't been our choice, because the opinion polls say the population want this controlled and they want it controlled yesterday.
Yes.
It has been the choice of our governments.
Yes. And once again, I point out that you, like Tomás Ryan, another very welcome contributor to our podcast, are a member of the Independent Scientific Advocacy Group, which wants us to suppress this virus aggressively, aiming for a zero COVID result, outcome. Now, before we go to the questions that about where the government is failing and how indecisive leadership is costing us, I want to ask you about schools, Professor Staines, because it is such a difficult problem for certain people. schools in general and schools for children with special educational needs. I'm looking at a piece in the Irish Times contributed by their excellent Europe correspondent, Naomi O'Leary. She's gone across Europe, Germany, Netherlands, Italy, France. No one has a settled policy, it seems, on schools, and everyone, all of these respective governments are dithering, I suppose. Is there something we need to do to protect teachers and to protect the communities? Because if you go back to the community from your school, isn't that the real threat?
Yeah, I mean, the highest risk group in the schools of all are the SNAs.
Yes.
So they typically spend a whole class session beside a particular child.
Yes.
Or one or two children.
This is the special needs assistants. Yes.
Special needs assistant. So they need to be given serious consideration. The schools for children with special educational needs have got to be a priority, because these children they're much more complex. They have much greater needs, and their families need a lot more support. And that I think they really need to be opened ASAP. And if that almost certainly means certainly vaccinating all the SNAs in those schools.
Yes.
And in due course, all of the teachers in those schools. But it's not a large number of people. So they need, yes, to come. They, I think, need to come back for the sake of the children, for the sake of their families. Other schools, the way to bring schools back safely is to suppress community transmission as far as possible.
Yes.
I mean, our argument has always been that we want to suppress this. We want to get COVID down as low as possible. Getting to zero requires you to get it as low as possible first. So let's get it as low as possible first and then see where we get to.
Yes.
Because once we get it down really low, that takes the pressure off the health system. It allows us to do all sorts of stuff, like make a decision that we are or we are not, but make a decision that we're going to open all schools, some subset of children back at schools. Different countries have taken different approaches. But,
yes,
but with the level of circulating virus we have at the moment, all of those are really challenging.
Now, the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, which the British gave their people early days, the British government decided that this vaccine needs a shot and then 3 weeks later, a second shot. The British decided, and their rationale was that they could give the vaccine to more people, to make that three-week gap between shots 12 weeks. The manufacturer said they did not agree with that. And there have been other people out over the weekend, scientific people, saying this reduces the British vaccination program to the status of a trial. In other words, they do not have, this is not a prudent course of action. The reason I'm asking you about that is that in case it arises here, because we do have a shortage of vaccine, and you know, the temptation might be to follow that. What's your opinion about that decision made by Boris Johnson's government, and Pfizer's response to it, which is we don't agree with this?
I think it's a high risk decision.
Yes.
There's a Scottish GP called Margaret McCartney, who would be well known in the UK, has had a very sensible response to it, which is this needs a trial. This, yes, needs to be tested. So we need to take a group of people and give them the vaccine now and give them the vaccine again at 12 weeks and take another group of people and give them the vaccine on schedule.
Yes.
And then see what happens to those two groups.
Yes.
And we could answer that question in probably, at current British rates of infection, we could probably answer the question in 3 months.
Right.
And that's her suggestion. I think she's absolutely right. But what's happened in the UK at the moment is the whole population has been conscripted into a badly thought out,
yes,
trial with no comparison group.
Yes.
Now, without their consent.
Right. And this brings me to a core issue we have to face up to, which is the open border we have with the Northern Ireland, which is the UK, and with the whole question of quarantine, the whole question of opening or closing the country up, if we can allow what seems on the face of it, our policy so far to airports and that has been irresponsible, negligent in the extreme, lazy and indecisive. And that's not hyperbole. It is irresponsible to allow people to fly into this country from the UK. It is wrong. Would you agree with that?
I think what we do in the airports now is irrelevant. Effectively, we have open airports. Anyone can come in. And we know that a wide variety of strains of coronavirus are circulating in Ireland. And these have come in largely through airports. So if we are deciding to go for living with the virus, recurring lockdowns, there's no point having airport quarantine. It's a complete waste of everyone's time. If we are deciding that we want to suppress the virus, bring it down to zero, restore our lives to something resembling normal, not fully normal, but closer to it than we are now, then without airport quarantine, without managing our border, without really putting resources behind public health to identify cases, to isolate their contacts, and supporting people to do that, without all of that, we won't get strong suppression and we certainly won't get to zero. So it's part of a package. It's not a solution itself. We could plow up the airport runways and plant cabbages on them. It would have no effect on its own. But as part of a larger package of measures with an aim, with a strategic aim to get to zero or to get to really, really low numbers, and we're talking 10 rather than 200 cases a day, then it is essential. Because what happens if you leave your airports open is that people come in and enough people come in who are infected to keep the epidemic going very nicely in your country. And if I look at the Australian figures, there's 50 or 60 people with COVID-19 in Australia now. They're all in quarantine in various airport hotels. That is more than enough to start a major outbreak all across Australia.
Yes. And Australia has a population of 25 million, and we don't. And it's let me get to the core thing now before we let you go, Professor Staines. An assertion I want to make that we have not got our act together. There is a coalition government with three parties in it. They don't appear to agree. When the question of airport quarantine, for example, was floated, the kite was floated, that Fianna Fáil and Micheál Martin might be in favour of that, it quickly became apparent over the weekend that the Greens and Leo Varadkar and Fine Gael would not be in favour of that. Mm. We are all over the place in terms of leadership on this question, it seems. If we remain in that state of indecisiveness, we cannot really begin to win this battle, or even if you call it a war, I would think you'd be using hyperbole. Can we?
No, we can't. Our choices are simple and plain. One is that we carry on as we are, wait for the vaccines to save us, and pray that no vaccine-resistant strains emerge and spread. And there's no way to predict whether that will happen or not. It might happen, it might not happen, but it is a real risk. That will get us back, all going well, to a more or less normal Christmas 2021.
Yes.
The alternative is to say, stop reacting to the virus. We are behind this virus all the time.
Yes.
we the virus is being managed by the NPHET, and I remind you, the E stands for emergency.
Yes.
We are way past the emergency response phase, but we're still getting emergency advice and emergency strategy and emergency implementation.
Yes.
So we need to get ahead of it. ISAG have articulated at least an evidence-based approach to managing this in ways that do not demolish everything, so that allow, for example, at the border, for the life of the communities around the border to continue.
Yes.
While bring it down, hopefully to work closely with our colleagues in Northern Ireland. And that's a matter for the government in Northern Ireland and the government in the Republic to decide themselves. I'm not the government in either country. But if I do, we are working with our public health and clinical colleagues every day, and we will continue to do that. But our governments have to get behind us and make a decision to bring this down, to try and get control over this virus to the extent we can. And the benefit of that is we restore large parts of our economy. The government is already talking about a lockdown that is going to go on probably to the end of April, well into May. And they're talking about opening pubs in November, if there are any pubs to open in November.
If they disappear, we'll have to reinvent them.
Well, yes, we will. Yes, absolutely. But if that's a choice.
Of course.
A political choice. But there is another political choice, which is to at least try to bring this right down. And it won't be easy. Don't underestimate what's involved, even in hotel quarantine. In Australia right now, there are 4,000 staff managing the hotel quarantine.
Right.
Now, Australia is a lot bigger than we are.
Yes.
But that gives you an idea of the scale
of
what's required to do it right. But it can be done. The Irish are not uniquely incapable. We're well able to do this.
Yes,
we just have to decide we want to do it.
And as you've pointed out in the last 30 minutes at one point, that the public are behind this. In every sample public opinion for all kinds of programs and media outlets, 90% of the people want tough, decisive leadership. And that's what's missing, isn't it, from this whole discussion as we speak?
Yeah, it is missing. But we're hopeful that Micheál Martin, who has previously taken major leadership in public health with smoking ban.
Yes,
we're hopeful that he will rise to the occasion again. But that's his choice.
Okay.
Without that level of leadership, we're going nowhere.
Okay, Professor Anthony Staines, a specialist in health systems and public health from DCU. Thank you very much for joining us on The Stand. Dr. Staines, Professor Staines, I should say, is also a member of a very important and growingly influential group, the Independent Science Advocacy Group, who are advocating for us to take the measures that would get ahead of this virus and reduce it to the number it was on the 2nd of July last year. You might be interested, if you're still there, Professor Staines. We had 3 deaths and 3 infections on the 2nd of July. We promptly opened the country up on the 4th, and away we went.
And that's where we should be going back to. And if I may do a very quick advertisement.
Yes, of course.
We're having a seminar about the border at 12 o'clock on Wednesday. And I believe somebody in your vicinity might be chairing the seminar.
I will be, yes. I will be.
I look forward to it.
It's very important, and it's quite intractable, the question of the border. But we have to try and do our best, and I'll see you on Wednesday. Thank you very much to Professor Staines, to all of you for listening, and of course a very special thanks to Tesco, our sponsor. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon. The Stand is proudly supported by Tesco. Tesco would like to thank customers for continuing to follow the in-store safety measures that help protect us all at this time. Now, more than ever, every little helps.